Welcome to Lena Live, hosted by Lena Miermond. I'm Julian Lampert, the producer. Today we have a special edition featuring Wolfgang Ketterle, who's professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor Ketterle won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2001, together with professors Eric Allen Cornell and Carl Wieman of the University of Colorado. Professor Ketterle and his colleagues earned the Nobel Prize for their work in the Bose-Einstein condensate, which is a state of matter that occurs at extremely low temperatures, close to absolute zero. And this state of matter was first predicted in 1924 and 25 by the physicists Satyendra Bose and Albert Einstein. Lena and I were honored to have this opportunity to speak with Professor Ketterle at his laboratory at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Let's have a listen.
My parents supported me and my siblings in pretty much everything we wanted to do. And we were all different, whether it was sports, whether it was a science kid, whether it was some other activity. They were supportive. And in the end, we three children, myself and my two siblings, went into very different directions. My sister is now a high school teacher, and my brother is CPA, Certified Public Accountant, and works in the business world, and I'm an academic.
Yes. The beauty of it, I also feel that you made that link or loop, because in your, I believe, either Nobel Prize lecture, one of your presentations, I was taken by your comparison with being physics and discovered something. You said that you feel like a child who find a toy and then you experiment with this. So you somehow, in my mind, the beauty of your childhood and whatever was seeded, you still feel there is certain continuation of that freedom of.
Yes, I would agree. Children have a natural curiosity, and sometimes they lose this curiosity, and that's bad. Being curious is a way to explore the world, is a way to ask questions, is a way to gain experience. And I sometimes say physicists, well, in some way, can behave like children. When they discover something new, they want to find out what it is. And what is a child doing? If a child finds something new, a new object, the child may shake it, may drop it, may squeeze it, just try out various things. When we discover a new form of matter, we literally squeeze it, we create some excitation and observe sound waves which propagate. We hold it. We want to figure out how long does the matter last before it transforms itself again or before it's lost. So in a way, there are some aspect of exploring the frontiers which children do, but scientists work in an analogous way.
And of course, we will be talking about your science, that heart of your life. But I like to still stay a little bit with your childhood. You said that your parents been trusting you and you did some experiment with even chemistry in your house. I remember personally for me it was painful because my son used to take apart every piece of tape recorder because he was searching for the sound. What you were searching for?
Oh. What was I searching for? I know I took things apart, but often I took them apart to repair them, and I was able to put them back together. It was just that, yeah, I was interested what is inside, and if something didn't work, it wasn't for me, something which is a closed box. If a toaster doesn't work, I took it apart. If an alarm clock doesn't work, I looked at it. It just seemed so natural to have a closer look, and a closer look means mm-hmm. take a screwdriver and open it up.
Mm-hmm. But you also been interested in sound. You created either tape recorder or something which created audio or stereo sound, I think. That was one of the avenues.
I had a tape recorder, and I was just collecting popular music. I like to listen to popular music. But I didn't have a stereo system that was expensive. But eventually, I found, or somebody gave me another old tape recorder, and I combined the two and was able to record a short stereo track. So I was sort of imaginative. If you have two mono, audio mono system, if you think about it and kind of combine the electrical signals, you can create something which is rudimentary stereo. So yeah, I was tinkering, you know, it's, you know, gadgets, electronics projects, putting extra lights into your room, or building something which sort of light show where light flashes in the rhythm of the music, and I build something like this. So I always like to have small projects and do them.
I do not want to take much of a tour from you and your childhood, but just to make a little comment, what you just said is so terribly important for parents to hear, and I hope they will, because today people live by trends. This is sport, which is incredibly important, and we will touch obviously in your running career, but there is not much of the attention it used to be a number of years ago for general development, for giving child opportunity to be curious, to experiment, to expand mentally and emotionally. It took very narrow channel approach. So I thank you for the fact that you described it in a such detailed, and I almost could feel that vibrance of your curiosity and sense of a process. And I think that's what my next point will be. Going to your school, you said that you've been very good in science and math, but lesser in language, but you made yourself work very hard, and you've been very excellent student. So did I say something right in your elementary school years?
Well, in school, and that includes elementary school and high school, I was always the best or the second best student in class, and my high school diploma is straight A. Wow. But I had a natural talent for science and math, and that was easy. But languages, sort of pronunciation, intuition for grammar and all that, that didn't come to me naturally. So I had to work at it. And so I worked much harder on languages than on science, because I wasn't so talented. But ultimately, I managed to get top grades also in the languages. You know, there are things, I sometimes said, some people can, when physics is for me understanding connections. But but some aspects of language, you may have to learn some parts of language as you learn how to use a typewriter. It's sort of a more the mechanics of it. You memorize it, you learn it by heart. I would say I don't have the, you know, absolute listening skill, and if you say something in a language, it would be hard for me, because I'm lacking the intuition, to repeat it in an accurate way. Just sort of to hear something, that's also in music, I wasn't a good musician. If I hear music, I was not able to sing it back or play it. So I know my talents were in science and math.
But that was not to simplify, but that was somewhat easier, because you already saw your world, your directions, and your passion. You didn't have to choose in between. It was a science. And that was a blessing, in a sense. And you had, I don't remember the name of this gentleman, but you had particular one teacher in school. And it's so important to have a person in your young age who was, I think, extremely important, and if not dominant, but it was like a guidance for you in your high school
I very well remember years. A math teacher who was really passionate about the subject. Mm-hmm. But a lot, when teacher teach something in class, mathematics, often, of course, what they have to teach is how do you solve equations, how do you do certain operations and such. But he challenged me with some extra problems. He gave mm-hmm. me sometimes extra problems. And those problems you sometimes cannot approach with a recipe. You pattern of a solution of another problem just doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. And what he conveyed to me is if you have a problem and you don't know how to start, and this is actually sometimes a crucial moment. We have a problem, but we don't even know how to tackle it. You sort of just play with it. You look at it from that side. If you think this problem doesn't make any sense, you figure out, you try to write down why it doesn't make any sense. And suddenly you realize, but it does make sense. Or you would say, well, I can't solve the general problem. But, you know, A square plus B square is C square, but I can maybe put numbers in it. Just look at one example. But suddenly by seeing an example, it may help me to understand it in general. So this more sort of playful approach, mm-hmm. where you just try to feel the problem, this is very important. And I think this is also how excellent scientists work. They have to work on new things. They have to shape their intuition. And this approach of my high school teacher, which he conveyed to me, play with it, look around, that was... It clicked with me. That was important. He also encouraged me to take part in a national competition for mathematics. And that's where students really get sort of really tricky problems, problems they haven't seen. And for two or three consecutive years, I was a finalist. So I was never a winner of this competition, but I came pretty far. And the process of working on those problems taught me a lot. It was very instructive.
One of the things, I'm so glad that you mentioned intuition, because science, even in a very smart and intellectually inclined people, is a set of facts. The concept of the process is not really respected that much, not appreciated that much. My late father was a scientist, and I was sort of speaking in a family where this process and tremendous passion took place. But the way you describe it, in fact, I would say that obviously there are certain concepts I could not grasp because I'm not a scientist. But I felt your passion, and it was with such articulation. It was with such incredible clarity that I remembered a lot of things, and I could connect to real life. And that's perhaps my next phase of the question. When did you find the connection of what you already know, what you already learned with life? I know there was a point when you did your thesis, PhDs, there was a certain crossroads, and I know you, please, yeah.
So when I went to the university and decided to study physics, I always had in mind some applied physics, to go to industry, develop some products. But to be an academic and do pure research just for knowledge wasn't really on my mind. Maybe because in your everyday world, where do you encounter science and technology? Well, in the form of gadgets you're using, and I wanted to be part of it. And also I felt maybe being in a company and producing something real is more tangible than just producing knowledge. But during my studies, I went a little bit back and forth. I did a theoretical master thesis, theoretical description of matter, and afterwards I said it was successful, but I was concerned that this would lead me to the ivory tower of science, just disconnected from society, and I decided to become an experimentalist. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to work on really applied problems. So I started with working with lasers and molecules in my PhD. And eventually, after my PhD, when I took a postdoc position in Heidelberg, I'm skipping some details, but the storyline is correct. Mm-hmm. I took a postdoc position in combustion research. You use laser light to analyze what's going on in a flame or what's going on in an internal combustion engine. Mm-hmm. So this is a situation where you know what you're doing, you know what it's good for. You use modern technology, the laser, to improve combustion, and that's for a cleaner environment. Yeah. So it's, I felt very motivated, and I was also happy that I felt I could contribute to current problems of society. Yeah. On the other hand, at the same time, when I went deeper into applied research, I had some collaboration with car manufacturer, and we went to their plant and used lasers to analyze combustion process in one of their engines. I was missing something. I was missing the more abstract challenge. I was missing the openness of a question. And that's maybe the difference between applied research. You have a clear goal. In fundamental research, you sometimes just push the boundaries of knowledge and want to see what is new. Or sometimes you go into a direction and define a project, but you don't even know if there's a solution. Mm-hmm. And I realized when I did this applied research that I was missing the more fundamental aspects. But secondly, I also realized when I was in combustion research, I was trained in basic science in molecular spectroscopy, and all the time when I worked on applied problems, I looked up papers, I used knowledge obtained in basic research. So I realized when I did applied research that the world will not just advance and develop new technologies and solutions to problems by just doing applied research and focusing on these problems. We need a knowledge base which is much wider. We need people who do basic research, and those results are available to those who want to do applied research. Just to give you an example, the laser is now an important tool. It's used in so many parts of the world in our daily life. But would a dentist have ever discovered the laser to do surgery on teeth? Absolutely not. It really required people who were passionate about light and wanted to understand how light and atoms interact, and eventually they discovered the laser, a new form of light. So anyway, I realized when I did applied research, I realized two things. One is that in society we need both. We need people who work on basic concepts, and that's that provides the knowledge for the scientific for technological developments 10, 20, 30 years later. But of course, we also need people who solve the important problems of today. But since both are needed, I felt I should go to the place, I should work in the area where I feel it's the best match to my talents. And that's what I often actually recommend young people. If you look at, you know, different options for choosing a field of study or different areas where you can take a job, yes, you should figure out what is relevant for you and what not. But in the end, you have to wear the suit which fits you. You have to work in an area which is a match to your talents. And I should say, I just enjoy going to laboratory, seeing all this laser light and such.
Yes, you said it looks so elegant.
So yeah. So I like it. And yeah. In a way, if you want to be successful, you have to work in an area where you enjoy what you're doing, well, every day, or at least almost every day. I mean, there are always days we hate it, but almost every day you have to enjoy it. If you feel I'm working for a whole year and I only enjoy suddenly the end of it, you will not reach the end of it. You will not be successful. Mm-hmm. So in any case, maybe I'm telling the story a little bit more in general, but I realized when I did applied research, which I enjoyed, but I realized I would enjoy fundamental research better. I'm talented for it. It's sort of more what maybe my brain is wired for. But at the same time, I also realized that by doing very basic science, I will make contributions, first contributions to knowledge, contributions to advancing the frontiers of science, but over longer periods of 20, 30 years, also to the challenges which mankind faces.
Quite extraordinary. I have to say that what you just said can be so applicable to musicians also,
yeah.
Because there are
agree, yeah.
Because it relates to so many directions, so much search. The challenge is, of course, of a more of an abstract thing, and the people feel they can survive without art and music. I don't believe it's close to the truth. But something on this line, I will try to make a parallel, but it will not be perhaps in the most clear way. Lavoisier made a connection. He said that the first we're dealing with the phenomena, then this phenomena in abstract form should be put in our brain, and then the brain should explain this in words. And you not only explain this so beautifully in words, but you made anyone understand the connection between this theoretic and between the essence of the science and how it's connect to real life, how we really can take benefits. And the laser is, you just said this, and it's not only, it's dentistry, it's of course eye, and now they're doing in a much wider spectrum of medicine. Around age of 32, in fact, I wanted to tell you that we just celebrated a few days ago a Mozart's birthday, and at age 32, he already had the world. At age 32, you had the world as well. You being, I think, if I'm not mistaken, either facing to come to the United States, or you already been here, but you already been scientists, you already had your children, you already had your future, and you already knew what you were doing.
Well, I wouldn't put it this way. At age 32, I was 32 when I moved from Germany to the United States, when I went from applied research, combustion research, to fundamental research, and when I switched from studying hot flames towards research on ultra-cold atomic matter. So this was quite a change. But in terms of being established, I was actually up for challenge. I left Germany. I left the field I had worked in. I came to the United States with a two-year contract as a postdoc to do research. And I had no guarantee what would come next. So I knew I was entering a new field. And in the next 2 years, I had to earn my next job. I had to impress people that they were willing to give me employment 2 years later. Mm-hmm. So I think therefore
I moved a little faster.
Yeah, so therefore I was actually in a situation which is less settled and less established. A lot of people in their early 30s, they have a permanent employment, or at least they have settled in an area. Whereas I had decided at age 32, I'm not starting from scratch because I had a PhD in physics and I had some knowledge, but I started all over in a new field where I had a lot to learn. I went to a new environment, and there was no clear career path which was laid out for me. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I felt, based on my experience, that I have the ability to learn new things. When I various postdoc positions in Munich and then in Heidelberg, I learned that I very, very fast learn and am able to, after a short time, to do contributions to the frontier of the field. So in that sense, I had the self-confidence, I can take the risk. I can choose mm-hmm. a field I want. I can choose a field I feel excited and passionate about it. And I just know that after a year or two, I will be one of the leaders and there will be continuation for me. I will find a job afterwards.
Well, I indeed was very much ahead. I established you much faster than you explained to us. But then it was extremely rapid. You picked up tremendous pace. But if I can go back a little bit, moving to the United States, that is huge change. I mean, being Eastern European myself, I know when I enter this country, it's just a tremendously challenging adjustment with perhaps more formality, more rules in Europe. This is much more liberated in schools. Students can wear what they want and they can perhaps be less formal with more of the equal mannerism with their professors.
Yes.
It's good, but it can be sometimes overboard. What was the most challenging for you?
Well, I would say in terms of adjusting to life, I felt it was rather straightforward. I always felt, almost immediately felt at home in New England. Of course, New England, the east coast of the United States, has some similarities to European countries.
Yeah.
So I felt I could feel at home. But the second aspect is that MIT, or the academic environment, is not the typical American environment.
Mm-hmm.
Here at MIT, we have a huge diversity of cultures, we have a huge diversity of different nations. Half of our graduate students are international, and probably half or even more of our faculty come from abroad.
Yeah, 50%, I think.
So I felt I was in an environment where you always found, you know, people to talk to and friends and such. And it was not that, I didn't feel it was a difficult adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge was for me, I felt a challenge in the science to, you know, come up to speed in a new field, to be productive, to try to be, you know, at a level of people who had worked in the field already for longer. And especially my postdoctoral advisor or mentor, Professor Dave Pritchard,
yes.
I really felt challenged by him because he was so sharp. He had those analytic skills. He had all the knowledge. And I know the first few weeks I worked with him, my jaw dropped and I said, wow, this is the challenge. I have to be able to talk to him. I have to be able to know the facts as well as he does in order to have an equal conversation with him. So this became the real challenge for me after coming here, after coming to MIT.
We will shift into the science field, and I think my son will ask you more intelligent questions than myself. But a little bit about Professor David Pritchard. I felt that he almost, or maybe even you said that yourself, almost like a scientific father, like a figure of a person who you've just been extremely fortunate to meet, because it was a tremendous human support and he understood in you tremendously powerful scientist. He understood your potentials. He understood your very strong working ethics and, of course, your talent. So it was a tremendous luck in a sense that you met him,
yes,
and that became, so to speak, beam of your light. And then with all of this, we will come soon to the glory of your Nobel Prize. But before that, I do not want to rush. Perhaps you want to ask Wolfgang about some scientific things which took start in United States.
In Wikipedia, I wanted to ask you about something that I read there in trying to educate ourselves about your work. There's a statement that I'd like to read to you. This is from Wikipedia defining the Bose-Einstein condensate. Einstein demonstrated that cooling bosonic atoms to a very low temperature would cause them to fall, or condense, in quotations, into the lowest accessible quantum state, resulting in a new form of matter. First of all, I'm wondering, is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, that's accurate.
And what does that mean?
Well, the way how Wikipedia describes it uses the language of physics. Let me first try to explain it to you in words, and I think then, once we have created sort of a picture of what is going on, I may more directly relate to what was said in Wikipedia. So what happens is if you have a gas of atoms, we all have an idea what happens in a gas in the air around us. There are particles in random motion. Air molecules or in an atomic gas, these are atoms, the building blocks of matter. But at high temperature, everything moves around randomly because there's a lot of thermal energy. High temperature means random motion. When we lower the temperature, everything slows down. So then everything slows down its motion, but it's still a random motion that everything moves in all directions. What Einstein described first in 1925 was a phase transition to a different form of matter. It's when you cool down the gas. You're familiar when you cool down water, suddenly, at a very specific temperature, the water freezes. It changes its properties. A gas of atoms, where you have random motion and you cool it down, suddenly there will be a large component of the atoms which no longer undergo random motion. They are sort of just in, to use a metaphor, they march in lockstep. So you can imagine that you have a gas where you have random motion, but then there is a component which marches in lockstep, and eventually all the atoms march in lockstep. And this is a very different form of matter at low temperature than the random motion at high temperature. So that is what's going on. Now, let me try to connect it to what is said in Wikipedia, and that's also how we describe it in the language of physics. We use the concept that particles have different states, different form of motion. And at high temperature, particles go left, right, up, down, in all directions at different velocities. So there are many, many forms of motion, many, many states involved. When we go to lower temperature, things start to slow down. That means fewer states are involved. But the special thing about the Bose-Einstein condensate is when the particles march in lockstep, scientifically it means they are just in one state. And that means also, using the language of quantum physics, that they just form one wave, one quantum mechanical wave. And this is sort of the characteristic of the Bose-Einstein condensate.
Is that, considering the vastness of space and obviously how cold it is, what you're describing, is that the basic state of matter? Its most basic state, in the sense of when the temperatures as if cannot get any colder?
It is the basic state or the ultimate state in the following sense. If you take a gas of atoms, they have to be bosonic atoms, but many atoms in the universe are bosonic atoms. If you cool them down, then below a certain temperature, there's a phase transition to Bose-Einstein condensate, and if you go lower and lower in temperature, the properties will not change anymore. So in that sense, the phase transition to Bose-Einstein condensation is sort of the form of matter which would exist all the way down to absolute zero. On the other hand, if you take water and water freezes at 0 degrees centigrade or 32 degrees Fahrenheit, you can now take the ice to absolute zero and it will stay ice. So in that sense, it's not so special that when you reach a phase transition, that's it, that nothing will happen at even lower temperature. Sure, the ice will get colder. That means that some vibrations of water molecules frozen in ice will slow down even more. Similarly, the Bose-Einstein condensate, which we form at the phase transition, has a very small amount of excitations, of there is still a little bit of random motion in it, part, you know, the particles march in lockstep, but there's a little bit of extra motion. And just this extra motion, this will eventually go away when you take the gas all the way down to absolute zero. The way of how I earned the Nobel Prize was to develop a practical way to realize this form of matter. So in those years leading to the Nobel Prize discovery, I had to develop techniques, how to get atoms closer and closer to absolute zero, how to bombard them with laser light, how to put them in magnetic fields, use sort of all tricks which combine all sorts of techniques which scientists had developed, modify them, be creative, how to combine things that everything worked, the gas became colder and colder and colder, and then this beautiful new form of matter showed up.
And the way you showed it in, we saw some of your videos, the way you explain and the way it showed it, I felt it's almost like a symphony orchestra or sound when you discovered this. And, you know, you described this, it was, I don't know, I think you mentioned even 6 o'clock in the morning or something. That was just the most incredible drive. And once you discovered that, that was as if the world took another laser cut in your mind. So I did not congratulate you in our letter with your Nobel Prize. May I do it now?
Thank you.
With tremendous... not only thrill, but respect for the fact that you put so much science first. And then, of course, it's a tremendous overjoy to have this recognition from the world. But I just feel that was almost like a consequence of your scientific pride for which you've been so well deservedly recognized. And I wanted to congratulate you for that tremendous drive, which I think started from the moment you've been born and brought you to such tremendous triumph. I cannot imagine your parents' joy and this little town you've been born and just the pride of your country for the fact that you've been so incredibly honored by one of the highest honor in the world.
Yeah, the Nobel Prize is a joyful event. You connect with many people, people remember you. You suddenly get email messages from people you went to school 40 years or 50 years before. Well, 40 years in my case. And you haven't met them for a long, long time. So it's really special. And it also connects you with your roots. You know that there were a lot of people, your parents, teachers and other people who have helped you to develop your talents.
Yes, yes. And one of the reason we wanted so much to meet with you is the fact that you really have this unique combination by the words of your colleague, Professor Kleppner. You are fantastic scientist, you're a wonderful teacher, and you're a fantastic colleague. this trio is very rarely combined today, because it's just question of time, question of energy, question of attention. Somehow you're doing this all. How?
I don't know. I mean, those things belong together. If I understand science, I want to teach it. I love to teach. I love to stand in front of a class and explain them science. And if I want to explain the science, I have to understand it well. But if I understand it well, it's also fun to teach and convey your thought process to other people. And even when you teach some science which is well known, there's still some aspect which people have not fully understood or do not fully appreciate. So for me, research to obtain new knowledge and teaching to convey the knowledge to other people really belong together. So I don't think it's an effort or it's sort of a conflict. For me, being a researcher and a teacher is sort of a unity. And even if I'm busy with research, I would not go to my department head and ask for a leave of teaching. I want to teach. I love to teach. I love every time I'm in the classroom. Maybe I hate it the night before when I have to prepare my lecture and stay up late, but I like the unity of teaching and research. And also, even if you're as good a scientist as you can be, you need colleagues, you need other people to really advance very far. Your own brain is too small to think about everything. I've often seen it when I had a new idea and I was explaining it to a colleague. Colleague made a comment and suddenly your idea became even better. So The scientific community and collegiality are also important aspects. So therefore, for me, it's not three different areas and you have to balance your time. For me, to be a scientist, teacher and interact with my colleagues is one thing which, and all the parts belong together.
Professor Ketterle is a passionate family man. He has 5 children. In addition, he's also a passionate athlete. In fact, Runner's World magazine featured him in their 2009 November edition. And we asked Professor Ketterle, what role do marathons and running in general have in his life and scientific work?
We've talked about my passion in science, but I have other passions. One, of course, is my family and 5 children. Another passion is running. I really enjoy running. I'm running 6 times a week. And this morning I was running 10 miles already. And It really energizes me. But let me tell you the story, that when I was in high school, I liked to run. I always liked to run the longer distances. So somehow endurance, being for something in the long run, I liked that. And when I was in high school, I was running regularly and I did some long distance competition. I was maybe locally competitive, but nothing really special. But then when I went to college, I focused on the academics, focused on my career. I didn't run a lot. But later on, when I was in my late 20s, I lived in Munich. In Munich, they started those city marathons. Now you have marathons in all the cities, but in the, just think back, that's, these were the early 80s. These were sort of the early marathons. And I saw those marathon runners. I'd never run a marathon before, but since I was a runner in high school, I felt inspired. And I said to myself, next year I run the marathon. So then in Munich for a number of years, I ran, I think, 6 marathons. And eventually when I relocated to the US, I said, oh, now I'm coming to Boston, the most famous marathon. But at that point, the career had taken over. I had 1, 2, and then a 3rd child. Family took over. I didn't do any serious running until I was past 50. And this was about 4 years ago that a friend of mine said, do you want to run with me a 10K race? And I looked at the website of the competition and said, 10K, half marathon, marathon. I pressed marathon and I made pretty much a spontaneous decision, I go back to marathon running. And I first thought, okay, I just wanted to see if I can still do it, set a goal for myself. So 2 months later, I ran a marathon. But I felt that exercising regularly was energizing me. The physical experience was providing a wonderful balance to the intellectual experience I have. So that was about 4 years ago, and I decided immediately I sign up for the next and the next and the next. So now for the last few years, since 2010, I've, so to speak, my second running career. I'm running actually more than I did when I was in high school or in my 20s, and I really get a lot out of it. And in hindsight, I would say, gosh, how could I really drop exercise and running for more than 20 years? Sure, I had good reasons, career, family and all that, but I think physical exercise, yes, it costs some time. If you run it right now, it takes an hour, a little bit more per day for me to do my run, but I get a lot in return. Whether it's physical fitness, whether it's just an amount of energy. You know, now if I run in the morning, I can come to the office here and I'm full of energy. So in hindsight, I would say, gosh, I should have gotten back into running earlier, but to get back in my 50s was really good. And
this is your unofficial another Nobel Prize.
No. Running is for fun. Physics is serious. Physics I do for a living, running I do for fun. But actually,
one helps another.
But so. Actually, I wasn't expecting that, but last year, when I was running marathons, I was running in Boston, Munich and New York, I was running marathons faster than I had done when I was half my age. So my absolute personal record in marathon running is from last year, and I'm now preparing for the Boston Marathon in April, and maybe I can run a personal record.
Wow.
Well, it just shows that when I was in my 20s, I did not develop my full potential as a runner. And now, maybe I'm enjoying it more, I'm more relaxed, I know more about running. I'm also running more than I did when I was in my 20s. I'm running 60, 70 miles a week. So, but I'm in good shape now. I can run fast. So this provides, of course, additional motivation and additional enjoyment. I can run. I can not only run, I can run fast.
If you ask a very basic music teacher who's very competent, but who teaches just a very basic craftsmanship, like a solid beginner's teacher, and you ask that teacher to play a scale, you will hear a very, provided it's a good teacher, you'll hear a very reliably, solidly played scale. Nothing further than that. If you ask a composer or an artist, a real artist, to play scales, you will hear a totally different demonstration of the scale. It's something that almost doesn't sound like a scale, but it sounds like a piece of music. And there's just endless ways that you can shape that scale. And if you ask those two different people, what is a scale to you, you'll also get completely different answers. And in terms of science, 1 + 1 = 2, at least still.
Yes.
And the teacher who teaches in elementary school, who teaches only arithmetic, may give a very basic proof of why 1 + 1 = 2. My question is, in the world of physics, especially the physics world that you come from, is there a profoundly deep, a much deeper meaning that is in between the numbers, between something that looks as deceptively simple as 1 + 1 = 2? Is there something that's profoundly mysterious and something that we all miss when we first learn arithmetic?
Not directly, but indirectly. Just to come back to the scales and the music, when you record the scale played by an expert and by somebody who is more technically sound, you hear the difference. And of course the difference are the transitions, the onset, how things develop and such. I'm not sure if you can directly apply that to mathematics or physics, because we have a body of knowledge, and we usually say those sciences are, well, exact in their assumptions. You make an assumption, you use logic for proof. So I would say certain aspects to show how you can prove a theorem. A high school teacher and a top researcher may actually do it in a similar way. However, for a teacher, this may be the subject he wants to teach. For an active scientist, what I teach is the science from yesterday, but it inspires me to do the science of today. So therefore, when I teach elementary physics, classical mechanics to students, I'm not teaching the subject of classical mechanics. I do, of course, but I'm not only teaching the subject how objects move, collide, what are the Newtonian laws of motion. I also try to teach that this is an example of a physics theory which provides you an idea how physics is done, how physics is done at the frontier of knowledge. So I try to make all kinds of analogies, sometimes in a subtle way. What is physics? How do you do physics? How do you apply physics? Or when I teach basic physics, I'm not just focusing on teaching the subject, transferring the knowledge. I want to show them the skills. So sometimes when I make a mistake in the classroom, I think it's good, because now the students experience a scientist in action. How do I find out what is wrong? How do I look at it? I'm not just redoing the calculation. I have sort of an intuition for troubleshooting. And these are the skills I use in my research. So I think there is an analogy. It's not so much you play a scale, you show an equation, and the equation is now different. Or maybe for certain musical tones, there are overtones, there are atmosphere, there are, you know, other things associated. I would not say that about 1 + 1 = 2 and about an equation, but the process how you use logic, how you derive equations. You can say it is just, you can just say there is knowledge in it, but for me as a scientist, knowledge is dead, but the process is alive.
Towards the end, Professor Ketterle made an enlightening parallel between music and science.
Science have some common denominators. It's really about human creativity. It's about finding something new. A lot in science is you combine things, but when you combine them, suddenly there is a difference. In music, you combine different elements, but suddenly the whole is more than the sum of the parts. It actually happens that a lot of people, a lot of actually famous physicists, were also excellent musicians. Maybe I'm an exception. I'm not a good musician. I just have no talent.
We don't believe it, since you're from Germany. It's not possible.
Thank you.